This is the United States Dressage Federation's official podcast. Hello, I'm Chris Stafford. On this week's episode, Terry Chiotogallo presents an extract from the 2013 Adequan USDF annual meeting that introduces the new USDF Continuing Education Musical Freestyle Elective Program. And we remember a legend in American dressage, Chuck Grant. And we begin with our trainer's tip of the week, which is brought to you by Annie Morris from Columbia, Connecticut. Annie is a USDF certified instructor through fourth level, a member of the training first level faculty, and a USDF bronze and silver medalist. Her topic is exercises to develop swing in the back.
Well, first of all, I'd like to explain what I mean when I'm talking about the swing in the back. The swing in the back happens in the most obvious way in the trot, and that's when the horse is in a symmetrical gait with a moment of suspension. And you can feel, if you've ridden a horse whose back is swinging, like this lifting back. And the energy is really swinging through. And that is what we're all looking for, as you said. Now, the swing also happens in the canter. I'm actually not going to talk as much about the canter because I really want to find the clear swing in the trot in this session. But the canter also has swing because it also has a moment of suspension. However, the walk doesn't have a swinging back in the same way, because there's no impulsion, because there's no moment of suspension. So I just wanted to clarify that. Then when do we start looking for the swing in the back? I would say that we look for that starting at the beginning, but really it's the most necessary as a prerequisite for collection. And what I mean by that is if you look at the pyramid of training, you can look at the very bottom, which is rhythm. And let's say we're talking about the rhythm of the trot, which is two beats. A horse can actually be in a pretty decent two-beat rhythm without swinging the back. And you still would be happy with that, maybe with a lower-level horse, because the rhythm is correct. However, as we said, we want to be then looking for the swing as we move on. The same thing with relaxation. Rhythm and relaxation are both going to be prerequisites for the swing, because a horse needs to be mentally relaxed to allow the energy to flow through his back and to have the muscles in his back relaxed. He also needs to be physically supple, which is a big part of relaxation, meaning he has positive tension in his muscles, not the negative tension where, you know, their back is tight and the muscles are really hard, but muscular strength that allows the top line to actually carry the rider better. Moving on to connection, which is the third thing in the training pyramid, the horse has to, before he can swing, be connected, meaning that the energy flows from back to front and he accepts the rider's contact as well as the seat and leg aids. Only once you have those things can you add impulsion, and with the impulsion we'll start to develop the swing. So I just wanted to put that into context about where the swing in the back comes, and now I can tell you how to start looking for it. I would say that the biggest enemy of swing, at least in my experience, is speed. People are looking for this big bouncy trot, so they drive the horse, but as soon as the tempo gets fast, you lose the moment of suspension. The horse actually takes a quicker, shorter step, and you lose the ability for the horse to swing to the back. Therefore, a steady, correct tempo is necessary, possibly using half halts that do include a driving aid, but also a little whoa that the horse can stay over his legs And actually, in a swingier trot, the tempo might get even a touch slower because the moment of suspension is longer. A few exercises to do to help figure out exactly where the tempo should be would be to trot around the arena. This maybe sounds a tiny bit boring, but it's really useful if you just trot all the way around the rail a couple of times, trying to make every single step exactly the same. You'll find out if you're in a self-perpetuating tempo. In other words, if you're in a tempo that you can maintain for that period of time and the horse maintains it, you don't have to make him go and make him whoa frequently because he has the self-perpetuating rhythm. Only from that rhythm and that correct tempo will the swing be able to happen. Try it both ways. Sometimes turning to the right, the horse might be more likely to speed up, for example, than turning to the left. And you, as a rider, can fix it with, again, little half halts, maybe a little go if you need, but trying to find a really consistent rhythm and tempo. If the half halt doesn't work, another thing to do would be a transition to walk, if the problem is that the horse is running, and then to trot again. And repeating that helps the horse find their balance and therefore a tempo that they have the ability to swing in. So that's a really basic way to begin looking for the swing, something you can do even with a horse that hasn't developed collection yet. Another thing that often helps is just riding trot and canter transitions. Sometimes the trot is a little flat. Maybe the canter also is a tiny bit out of balance, but sometimes using the transitions to build the impulsion, again, for example, in maybe a lower level horse who just is consistent in the bottom of the training pyramid and working on impulsion, doing trot canter transitions frequently helps develop the better quality of the trot where the rider can look for the swing. Another thing to do with a horse maybe who's doing training in first level would be to ride long leg yields, like, for example, across the diagonal or from the center line to the wall on a really consistent line to help them reach better in the rhythm, because that'll help develop the moment of suspension if they can reach more underneath, for example, with the crossing hind leg. That will give them more room in to push off and therefore to develop a better moment of suspension and therefore develop the swing. So those are some things to get started with, maybe with like I said, the training in first level horse. And what you want to feel is that when you start to sit on this horse, the back kind of pops up and you can feel the rider being lifted. And then that's when you can start to work towards more collecting exercises to develop the swing. For example, 10-meter circles, shoulder in, haunches in. And these are all things maybe that everyone is already doing. But if you're thinking about really the quality of the rhythm, the horse's ability to swing and stay consistent, whether you're doing shoulder in, whether you're going right, whether you're going left, whether you're changing direction or doing a volte, that is going to start to turn into a more correct collected trot with swing. Another thing that will really help is to find the ability to do transitions within the gate. So we'll say from collected trot to medium trot, or with the lower level horse from working trot to lengthening, trying not to let the horse speed up, but instead to take a longer stride with more suspension. Again, these are all movements in the test, but if you think about them in a specific way to develop the quality of swing in the trot, I think you will end up with a better collected trot. So thank you, Chris. That was my tip for the week.
Well, thank you so much again for coming on the program. We really appreciate it, Annie.
Yes, my pleasure. Thank you.
As part of our series on American legends in dressage, we take a moment this week to remember Chuck Grant, who introduced dressage to the Midwest. E.G. Charles Chuck Grant was inducted into the USDF Hall of Fame in 1997. The trainer of 17 competitive Grand Prix horses, an instructor and noted author, Chuck Grant introduced dressage to the Midwest and inspired students for generations. Growing up on a farm in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, Chuck spent many hours riding the farm horses bareback. After high school at the age of 19, he signed up to pursue a college degree in maritime engineering. That summer, in 1934, Grant discovered the 122nd Field Artillery and soon changed his course to join the National Guard unit, where he could ride horses every day. A fellow serviceman gave him James Phillips's 19th century training classic, Breaking and Riding, and Grant became interested in training horses, reading every book on the subject he could find. U.S. Army colonels Isaac Leonard Kitts and Hiram Tuttle were two of Grant's equestrian role models. He would watch closely all that they did and duplicate it as best he could, as he wasn't allowed to approach senior officers to ask them questions. After World War II, Grant went to work for a riding academy in Chicago, eventually purchasing his own equestrian training facility, Plush Horse Stables, also in Chicago, Illinois. He befriended two of his boarders, Paul Sternholm, a Dane who'd been a major in the U.S. Cavalry, and Arthur Conyot, head of the famed European circus family. Both men helped further Grant's equestrian education. Grant's first wife, Emmy Temple, a rider from Ohio, soon joined the three men in their discussions, forming an informal dressage group. In 1947, Emmy taught the first civilian dressage lessons in the Midwest at Plush Stables. Later that same year, Grant judged the first dressage show in the Midwest in Morton Grove, Illinois. For 10 years, from 1969 to 1979, Grant led an exhibition troupe, the Horse Capades, which included some of his advanced students. Performing classical and high school dressage, the Horse Capades also included a comedy routine or two. Due to time and money constraints, the group gave its final performance in 1979. In 1978, with second wife Carol Grant Alford, Grant established Shine a Bit Farm in Brighton, Michigan. He insisted that dressage was for every horse, bringing 17 horses to Grand Prix, including Shining Gold, Bit of Shine, Shine a Bit, Miss Prince, Prussian Dudley, and Tarnished Gold. Grant trained Appaloosas, Arabians, Saddlebreds, and Thoroughbreds, and taught hundreds of students, including such well-known dressage riders as Dominique Barbier, Violet Hopkins, Marianne McPhail, and Nancy Poloska. Grant is the author of the books American Dressage, American Dressage 2, and Haute École, and also penned numerous magazine articles. Being largely self-taught, he developed his philosophy of training based on his observations, his common sense, and his reading. He believed that one cannot teach a horse something he does not already know. Instead, the key is to learn how to communicate and to ask correctly. Many who have read Grant's books, or who were fortunate enough to have studied or conversed with this modern-day master, recall the key point of his teachings. Quote, ask frequently, expect little or nothing, reward generously. You can find more information on Chuck Grant at the Rumor USDF Hall of Fame. There is also a feature article on his life in the May issue of USDF Connection. And finally, on this week's episode, an extract from the 2013 Adequan USDF annual meeting, in which Terry Chiotogallo introduces the new USDF Continuing Education Musical Freestyle elective program.
I'm very excited to present this to you today because it's a much needed program. It started at last year's convention. That's where the idea came to revive or to redo the former L elective program, which was a weekend long program, and to confine it, to define it a little bit better, to make it more judge friendly, more judge appropriate. So yes, it was conceived at convention last year, and 9 months later we gave birth to Understanding and Assessing Artistic Impression. The importance of this program is that it sets a standard. And what I mean by that is, regardless of who is going to be teaching it or where in the country you are, it is going to be the same curriculum that gets followed. So all the judges will be taught the exact same program. And this is a good thing. Now, it was conceived for judges, but anybody can attend. Know that while it was designed with judges in mind, everybody benefits from it. Competitors, judges, even freestyle designers, because we use a lot of this language and we use it frequently, and sometimes we use it incorrectly. So it's important that we all be able to communicate with each other intelligibly and that we're using the words the same way. So this becomes a little bit more specific in terms of how we see dressage judging for freestyle. It's around the score sheet, and we do open up the day with a brief comparison between the USDF and the FEI score sheets. Hopefully, this is the kind of program that will attract not only our L graduates, but all the way up through our higher level judges, because the philosophies behind it, FEI and USDF, are a little bit different, but the terminology is the same, and the ideas and the concepts that support even our national level tests do go up to the FEI level. So we do hope that judges of all levels would consider taking this program. There are some philosophical differences. See, Gates Impulsion and Submission is on the left-hand side of the score sheet for USDF, and the FEI handles it a little bit differently. Also, the FEI must be judged in half-point increments, whereas at the USDF levels, we do allow 10th increments, 0.1, as you do the artistic impression, and the reason behind that is because the coefficients are large. What we do is we take the USDF score sheet and we break it down. So we will start with music, and music has several categories to it. It has suitability, cohesiveness, and seamlessness. And we will attack each of those words individually. We define them. We give plenty of examples. You're going to get a taste of that. And then we bring it all back together so that you can learn how to assess it. So let's go on ahead and start with suitability. Suitability is the most important part of the score for music. You might think, well, it's all there in a generality, but we're going to try to set this up the same way as you would judge if you were doing a technical movement and you wanted to judge on the technical part. You're going to have a main criterion, and then you're going to have modifiers to bring your scores up or down. In this particular case, the most important part of the music score is suitability. And I'll tell you up front, if you have suitable music for all three gates, you're looking at a 7, and then we'll modify up or down from there. So now we're going to try to give you some teeth as you judge so that you've got something that you can grab onto. So what is suitability? Well, it should enhance the horse's way of moving, or at least it should not detract from it. Even if the horse has some issues, if the music makes the horse look better, that is suitable. I mean, you can always judge the gait, you can always judge the movement, but if the music is actually enhancing the way the horse goes, even if he's not a wonderful horse or he's got some issues, you can credit the rider for that. Now, music is everything that happens before the show. And what I mean by that is it's all the choices that the rider makes in terms of whether or not the music is suitable for the horse, whether or not all the music belongs together or is cohesive, and whether or not it's edited well or it's seamless. Other issues of suitability or if it fits the character of the horse. There are also other kinds of suitability, such as level appropriateness. Now, you've probably gone to shows, I'm sure you've all seen somebody do Pirates of the Caribbean. It's a big, heavy, dark piece of music that most first-level riders really have no business doing. That's level appropriateness, or suitability. The good news is most music is suitable for most horses, especially if you're talking about a dance form, like a jig or swing music. If people dance to it, it's going to make your horse look great. But the good news is, again, most music is suitable for most horses. And if it's not, it's going to be very apparent. Horses need a little buoyancy. And if you've got dark, heavy, dramatic music with a horse that needs a little, it's not going to be appropriate music. It's not going to be suitable. If you have music that's very rapid sounding, got a lot of energy to it, it can actually make the horse look nervous or make him look tense. And to my eye, sometimes it even flattens out the gait. So that's what we mean by suitability. It has to really make the horse look good. Now, if suitability is the most important part of the music score, then its modifiers are cohesiveness and seamlessness, with cohesiveness being the most the next most important part. Cohesiveness means exactly what it says. It sticks together. What makes this program stick together? Well, there are several things that you can use for that. It all fits the same genre. So it's all jazz or classic or rock. There are other things that can hold it together, like a theme. Instrumentation is probably the most common way to hold music together. And what do we mean by that? If everything is a full orchestra, it's cohesive. If everything is a small combo, it's cohesive. The other thing is a particular instrument. So I'm sure some of you have seen the Peruvian pan flute stuff. That sticks together not only because it's the same genre, but because you have that pan flute that goes from the trot to the walk to the canter. So it's a feature instrument that holds it together. It could be a piano, it could be a guitar, it could be a flute. Anything that you hear that threads through holds it together. Kind of like a running stitch, if any of you remember your running stitches from sewing. Seamlessness is also a modifier. It's the weakest part of the freestyles that I see. The reason that it doesn't improve is because the judges aren't taking off, and until the judges take off and make a note, it's not going to get better. What do we mean by seamlessness? There should be nothing in the presentation that disrupts your ear, nothing sharp that hurts you. And I'm going to give you an example so that you can actually hear it later on. Mostly you're going to hear these cuts. If any of you like your computer keyboard commands, X means cut. And if you were making a notation while the writer is going and you put an X, you know that means cut. Cut, very good. It was nice and seamless. Cut, oh my God, it hurt my ears. And fades, how we can make that better or not. You're going to be tested now. We know that cohesiveness means that it sticks together either because it's all from the same genre, because it's held together by its theme, or because it's held together by instrumentation. Seamlessness means that it has nothing in there that hurts your ears. So what we're going to do, judges, you're going to be very busy during a show, but now we have lots of time to really think about this. I'm going to play you some music. I want you to see if it sounds cohesive and why or why not. See if you can determine the order of the gates. That's what we're going to listen for right here. How would you characterize the music? Is it dark? Is it light? Is it happy? Is it sad? What's the character of the music? And that will probably lead you to whether or not it's suitable for a lower level horse. And seamlessness, of course, is stuck in there. Got a pretty good feel for that? Okay, was it cohesive? Why was it cohesive? All full orchestra. What were the order of the gates? Canter, walk, trot. We spent a lot of time talking about interpretation, how music must match the footfalls in order for the judge to have the clearest idea of how the music and the movement relate. However, you noticed right here, right now, that even without the horse, you knew what the gate was. That's what we mean by music expresses the gate. So even in the absence of the horse, you kind of know what's going on here. How would you characterize the music? Dark, heavy, dramatic, yes. And so do you think it would be level appropriate for the bottom levels? So you don't want to see a training level horse to that music. Okay, I'm going to tell you that that music was extremely edited. But did you hear anything in there that disrupted your ear? That's what we mean by seamlessness. Now, it might be interesting for you to know that the canter did match the footfalls and the trot didn't match the footfalls, but the walk did not. Now, the reason that we did it that way is because there was this beautiful natural transition in the music from the canter to the walk. Why would we want to disturb that? So as long as the music is still expressing the gait, you can give the writer credit for that as being good music for the walk. Will you hear this? Oh, yes, you will. What I'm about to play for you. From the trot music to the walk. Okay, how many of you have heard that at a show? That is called an abrupt cut. We cannot accept this. Now, you might say, oh, but it's a lower level writer. Can't you give them a little latitude? And I'm going to tell you, if the writer put together their own music, they were probably using an editing program. Even if they took that program down from the internet, free, every editing program has the ability to add fades. So, if they did it, they could sound like this. The edge off. Perfectly acceptable. I might expect a little bit more from an FEI writer, but for our national level writers, this is fine. Now, one of the other things that they do that you have to be a little bit careful for is sometimes they'll take a fade and they get a little carried away with it, and they let it go on for a little bit longer. It's like falling off a cliff, you know. Yeah. Okay. Now what happens in this particular case is if the writer has been spending a lot of time supporting the movement with the music, and now all of a sudden they do this long fade, what do you think is going to happen visually to the movement? It's going to start to fade too. Okay, so when we start talking about seamlessness and editing, these things do become important. If they have one little bumpy thing in there and it's been an otherwise good ride, you might let it slide. But if there are a series of them, you have to mark it off. What do I mean by mark off? Oh, you know, you don't want to kill them because seamlessness is really not what the main thing is all about. The main thing is about suitability. But if you've got a series of abrupt cuts, you're looking at 3 to 5 tenths off on the score. You have to, because if we don't ask them to make it better, it won't. Because again, music is fairly independent of anything that happens on that day. It's everything that they have done to prepare for the show. Unless it's a disaster, and what do I mean by that? If there are a number of disobediences or resistances that do not even allow you to determine whether or not the music was suitable, which is the main criteria, then yes. In that particular case, the technical execution is definitely going to interfere with the music score. But by and large, if you've got a fairly decent performance, you can say no. Music is independent of your technical execution. There are, by the way, tempos. There are no right or wrong tempos for the horse. It's where the horse is at that particular moment in his training. Music matching footfalls is not a rule, but it's the clearest way to show the relationship between the music and the movement. We talked about six-point interpretation, which means every time there's a change in phrase in the music, you would like to see something happen in the movement. And there are six places that you as a judge should expect to see the writer show you musical phrasing. At the initial halt and salute, and the chord stops, they either halt or they salute. And that is the most, we'll give them the most leeway, because sometimes the sound man screws up their music. And we're smart as judges, we know that, and so we don't penalize the writer for the sound man. However, once they move off that halt, the first phrase change, they should show a movement change. They should show a phrase change when they start their trot lengthening. They should show a phrase change when they start their canter lengthening. And of course, when they change their music at the gates, they should coordinate that. They shouldn't get stuck with, oh my God, I'm going to make my transition at E and the music is still going on. When the music transitions, they should transition and adapt their walk pattern to make it fit. It's easy to do. I've seen riders do it all the time. And the final center line, and you've all seen it. They halt and the music goes on and on and on. They have to be able to prepare for that. So if they have music expressing the gates, remember when we listened to cohesiveness before, if the music supports all three gates, we're looking at a 7. Usually we have a main criteria and separate modifiers. This is an exception, my apologies, because they're both main criteria for the interpretation section. We have music expresses the gates. If they can express all three gates, you're looking at a 6. And if it's glaringly apparent because they've matched the footfalls, which is very difficult for them to do in show situations, then it goes up a little bit higher. If they can show you that 6-point phrasing, even if they don't have music that's supporting all of the three gates, you're looking at a 7. Now, if they can show you both suitability for all three gates and their 6-point phrasing, you're looking at an 8. And you shouldn't be shy about going higher than an 8 if they really show good musical interpretation and can show lots of changes on phrases. So we've covered the same thing. We did the analysis. We talked about examples. We showed you how to evaluate. We talk about above the level. We talk about what is degree of difficulty. We review it here. We do the same thing for choreography. Choreography has many parts to it. The most important part is not creativity, it's design cohesiveness. Because if the choreography does not stick together, you are not going to be able to identify whether or not they've used the arena well, have good balance, or have been creative, because it's all over the place. Sometimes writers think they're being very creative and they do these patterns that you can't even figure out what they're doing. That is not a cohesive design. So the most important part of a choreography score is cohesiveness, which is modified by use of arena balance and creativity, with creativity probably being the largest of the modifiers there. We talk about that a little bit. We use all the criteria that are used in choreography to evaluate the Pre-St. George program, and then we take that same Pre-St. George program and show how we can move it around to exemplify all the things that need to go into choreography. I don't have time to go through all of this, I'm sorry, but we do it for first level trot and canter. We talk a little bit about asymmetry. So long as the rider has done everything they're supposed to do, which is to have an understandable and clear pattern, to use the arena in its entirety, to distribute the elements throughout, to have a fairly equal use of right and left rein work, then it doesn't matter whether or not it's symmetrical or asymmetrical. We talk a little bit about creativity, what it means to be creative, how you can take even a test pattern and make it creative using uncommon lines. And we talk a little bit about harmony between horse and rider, and we cover this last. And the reason we cover harmony last is because it's so comprehensive. Includes everything. And once you understand what it takes for a rider to have to do all the stuff they gotta do in order to present to you a good freestyle, and on top of that it's still harmonious, that's something. That's really something. And on any freestyle that you see, you're looking for this relationship between the horse and the rider, whether or not the horse displays confidence, if he's calm, if the execution has ease and fluidity to it. You expect that on anything, a standard test, a freestyle, but now put on top of it all the things they have to do for a freestyle and think higher score. Okay, and then we do a quick review of everything that we discussed earlier in the day. Yes, there is definitely an interrelationship between technical execution and the artistic marks, but not in the way that it used to be. Because it used to be, if these are your technical marks, then we're going to say, okay, we can go 10% over that for your artistic marks. No go. We have a very, very specific set of criteria that we've just gone over, or that at least you got to glaze over. That's what you base your score on. Still, there is a relationship. So, yes, harmony is directly related to the technical execution. Yes, degree of difficulty is directly related to the execution, because if it's not executed well, you cannot award or reward the difficulty. However, we already talked about music being fairly independent of technical execution unless there's a blow up and you can't tell what the heck's going on. Well, the same thing is true for interpretation. They may have planned to make the trot extension happen at that corner at that time in the music, but there was a disruption in the presentation, so they couldn't make it there. So yes, in that sense, technical execution interferes with the interpretation. And the same thing on the choreography. If there are disturbances and you can't tell what's going on, or that shoulder in developed very late and they didn't hold on to it long enough and you can't tell what's going on, yes, that's going to affect your choreography score because you didn't see it long enough. It affects your design cohesiveness score. And the afternoon section, it's a methodology. What is methodology? The system that we're using, you know what you knew, you already know this part on technical execution, and how we've adopted this or adapted it for the freestyle. You've got your primary criterion, your modifiers to come up with your score. So we're going to stick with that because you already know it. And that's how we come up with our scores. We do a brief review and then we go on to what is mandated versus personal methodology. The mandated stuff is stuff you got to do, or your rule violations. Your personal is how you deal with assessing the artistic categories. So you know if they're missing a mark, it gets a zero. Personal methodologies, I really wish I had time to talk about it more, but it's how you can track movements throughout the freestyle so that as you're watching and you're telling your scribe the scores that you're giving, you're still making notations on the artistic. Is this easy? No. If you've judged freestyle, you know it ain't easy. And then at the end of all of this, what do you have to do? Your freestyle test is over. You've got to assess your artistic marks. You have to make comments. You want to probably try to track some stuff for yourself so that later on, if someone asks you a question, you know what they're talking about. And you got 2 minutes to do it. It isn't so easy. So we're going to talk a little bit about personal methodologies and how to deal with all that. And this is based on a checklist that's already out there so that you could track your own scores, only it's specific to the USDF score sheet. What do you do on show day? How you prep your scribe to do the freestyles? And that's the end of the day. After that, come back with full freestyles, and they're going to be asked to judge the full freestyles, not the technical. The whole purpose of this is to learn how to judge the artistic impression score based on criterion that they've learned, not on, oh gee, I thought that was good.
You can find more information on the Continuing Education Musical Freestyle Elective Program on the website at usdf.org. This podcast is available for download on iTunes. Visit eTrack, the USDF's online learning center and resource for dressage and equine education at usdf.org. The USDF is your connection to the American dressage community.